This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. The idea that nature is important to our well-being and healing has been around for a very long time. More recently, scientists have investigated how the environment affects our brains and bodies. Today, we'll take a look at how our environments, natural and built, affect our health, and how the tenor of the times also affects our health. Our guest this afternoon is a medical doctor who's done extensive research on brain-immune interactions and the effects of the brain's stress response on health. We all know stress. It can save your life. Stand your ground and fight or head for the hills. It's an ancient survival mechanism. But stress, if chronic, can lead to lots of problems. Our guest this afternoon is Dr. Esther Sternberg. She's the author of Healing Spaces, The Science of Place and Well-Being. WILL hopes this program will help as so many of us struggle with the state of the economy. In an article Dr. Sternberg wrote earlier this year, she noted a recent study released by the American Psychological Association reported that 8 out of 10 Americans surveyed have felt stressed over finances in the weeks since the stock market took its first precipitous plunge. This summer, WILL held community conversations on the economy in Champaign, Macon, and Vermilion counties, and we heard a good deal about stress. So what we're doing is we're turning what we learned from those conversations into special reports and programs like our conversation with Dr. Sternberg this afternoon. You'll find these reports and programs here on AM 580 and soon at the website we're building at willconnect.org/economy. Listeners, join us with your questions and comments. I look forward to hearing from you. Join us with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our guest, Dr. Esther Sternberg, is the author of The Balance Within, The Science Connecting Health and Emotions. She's done extensive research, as I mentioned, on brain-immune interactions and the effects of the brain's stress response on health. She was on the faculty at Washington University, St. Louis, prior to joining the National Institutes of Health in 1986. Her new book, Healing Spaces, The Science of Place and Well-Being, is published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. And you'll find her online at www.estersternberg.com. Again, the phone numbers, if you'd like to join us this afternoon, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I look forward to your telephone calls this afternoon. Dr. Sternberg, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thanks for so much for calling me.
Oh, my pleasure. So let's start off with the title of your book, which is Healing Spaces. And you've written in the book that we need to be aware that the word healing is a verb. And you also call healing a perpetual march. You want to talk about those two ideas?
Yes, and I think that a lot of people think that they equate healing or health with curing. And in the book, I quote a researcher, actually she's here at NIH, Dr. Ann Berger, who told me that healing is not the same as curing. Healing really is a continuous process that the body goes through, that every single cell in our body goes through whenever we are exposed to any sort of insult from the environment. Whenever anything happens, you can imagine if you stub your toe. If there wasn't a process of healing going on within those cells of the skin and the muscle underneath, that you could end up with an open sore on your toe. There's a continuous process that goes on where it looks like our skin is very quiet and nothing much is going on underneath our skin, but there's constant activity of all the cells of the body, the cells of the immune system, the cells of the nervous system that talk to each other and allow the body to heal.
When and how did human beings name and describe stress?
I talk about that in the book as well, and actually in my previous book, In the Balance Within. The concept of stress goes back very, very far. to the beginnings of historic time, except it wasn't actually called stress in that sense. The Romans used a similar term that meant to squeeze. People were aware that they would find themselves in situations which were unpleasant, which were difficult to deal with, which made you feel uncomfortable. It was Hans Selye in the 1930s, 40s, 50s who really coined the word stress and borrowed it from the physicists. He used it in the biological sense to mean the body's own way of responding to any demand. And I describe him from personal memory in the book because I grew up in, my father was a professor at the University of Montreal, was a colleague of Hans Selye, whose labs were just two floors down from my father's. And I grew up, we used to play, my sister and I used to play in my father's labs, and sometimes, probably not accidentally, wander down a couple of floors, and we'd see Hans Selye in the distance with his flock of students behind him. And so I grew up knowing, hearing a lot about Hans Selye, and in the book, what I try to do is bring him to life and his colleagues' views of him to life, because, in fact, in the 1950s and 60s, and even through the 70s and early 80s, the idea that stress could make you sick was really held with great skepticism mm-hmm. by other colleagues in the medical community. It was certainly embraced by the popular culture, but until we in the scientific and medical community had the tools, the scientific tools to understand these connections between the brain and the immune system, between stress and illness, and ultimately between belief and healing, these notions were really viewed with great skepticism and even dismissed by the academic, scientific, medical community.
Yeah, I have an acquaintance who, it's been many years now, maybe a couple of decades ago, but she went to a physician, and she didn't remain with that doctor because he said he didn't believe in stress.
That's great. Well, I have many, my colleagues and I in this field have had many, many similar experiences, which I describe in the book. But when I give my lectures, I actually often start with the question to the audience, how many of you believe in stress? And, of course, it's 100% people raise their hands. If I ask how many people believe that stress can make you sick, the same thing, 100% raise mm-hmm. their hands. But when I first had the courage to pose that question to an academic medical audience, as late as 1996, and I say courage because if one did raise that in an academic community, one could be run out of the room. The scientists in the audience looked very stressed, but wouldn't admit that they actually believed that there was such a thing as stress. But the good thing to report is that there has been a sea change in the academic, scientific, and medical community. In understanding, in believing in these concepts, and really the reason is that we have the scientific tools that prove beyond a shadow of a doubt not only how stress makes you sick, but what stress is and how these connections between the brain and the immune system can explain that relationship between stress and illness. And as I said, the flip side between relaxation or salubrious activities or believing in something and wellness.
Hmm. What do we know at the moment about the effects of chronic stress on our health?
Oh, there's a lot of information now and more coming out every month. We know that chronic stress prolongs wound healing. We know that it reduces the take rate to vaccine. We know that people who are chronically stressed will have more severe and more frequent viral and bacterial infections. And you can imagine that the combination of those three events is not a very good situation. If you're, for example, a chronic caregiver of an Alzheimer's patient and you want to protect your loved ones, so you're chronically stressed, you go out and get a flu shot, and it doesn't take well because you're chronically stressed, you get sick, so your loved one gets sick. So there's a really important rationale to reducing one's stress to the extent that one can. You can't always get rid of the bad thing in your life or the bad thing that happens. but we can talk about a little later what are the kinds of things that can be done to cope with stress to reduce the negative effects on the body. But before I talk about that, there are two other important effects of chronic stress, and one of them is speeding aging of chromosomes. So as we age, the little ends of chromosomes get shorter. They get frayed, kind of like shoelaces get frayed if they're old. And stress can speed that process. Turns out that doing a number of things that maintain wellness and that help healing can actually slow that speeded up process, can interfere, can prevent stress from having those negative effects.
Hmm. I mentioned in my introduction that you wrote a piece recently on the biology of stress and the financial meltdown.
Yes.
And, you know, the New York Times science writer Natalie Angier recently wrote a piece on stress. And
yes.
She referred to our David Lynch economy,
yes.
Which was, I thought, a wonderful mm-hmm. way of putting it. Makes us laugh. Maybe that takes a little bit of the stress away.
Mm-hmm.
But you've written in this piece, The Biology of Stress, that we're in this perfect storm of stress. What do you mean?
Well, so you mentioned in your introduction that that stress is good for you. Not so much stress, but the stress response. So maybe we need to back up a little bit and
okay.
give some definitions. So when people think about stress, they usually think about all that bad stuff that happens. Well, that's only one part of stress. So if we go to the economy, the crash and the financial crisis, is the bad thing that happens. That's the trigger. But it triggers a whole lot of different events in our brains and in our bodies that are our reaction to stress. So there's the physiological response to stress. That's what you feel when you're exposed to something bad that happens. Your heart is beating fast, you're sweating, you feel anxious, you want to run to the bathroom. All of these things are part of the physiological stress response. Those are the nerve chemicals and brain hormones that are now flooding your system that are making you feel that way. Well, there's a reason for that. The reason is that those same nerve chemicals and stress hormones that make you feel bad also give you the energy to focus your attention, to fight or flee, to get out of danger. The reason we all, and I say we, whether we're a fruit fly or a fish or a mouse, a cat, a rat, a human, all living things have a stress response. And the reason is we need it to survive. We need it to get out of danger. If we didn't have a stress response, if you were a mouse and you didn't have a stress response to a cat, if you were wandering around in a new field and a cat comes along, instead of jumping up and running, you'd go to sleep and you'd get eaten
mm-hmm.
by the cat. So we have a stress response to save us. It's life-saving. The problem is if that goes on too long, if our bodies are exposed to all those nerve chemicals and stress hormones for too long, then that's when we get sick.
Yeah. I wouldn't want to be a mouse, for example, in a room of cats.
Well, maybe that's really what's happening now in
yeah.
the economy. And so to get back to the question of a perfect storm, so one of the important triggers of the stress response that is life-saving is novelty. When we're exposed to a new situation, that makes us get on the alert. We become vigilant. We look around. We are alert, and we're ready to flee. We are ready to get out of danger. So novelty is a very strong stimulus to the stress response. Just think of the first day at school, for whether you're a child or an adult. Think of when you move to a new house. Think of when you move to a new city. Novelty is a potent stressor of trigger of the stress response. Another very potent trigger of the stress response is uncontrollability. If you have some degree of control over that stressful situation, you can actually lower your stress response and feel stimulated. It's an exciting feeling. I describe in the book Disneyland, Disney World, and how the Disney Imagineers captured this brilliantly by figuring out the kinds of things that could trigger the stress response, which really makes you feel excited and stimulated, but give the people within these rides a degree of controllability so that they don't feel overly stressed and overwhelmed. They just feel excited. I describe the workings of the Pirates of the Caribbean in the book, and in order to do that, I actually had a behind-the-scenes tour of Disneyland, which was great fun to see how they figured out, the designers figured out how to do this. But there are lots of cues that that we are exposed to that we may not even be aware of that can trigger the stress response in our environment, and that's really what I talk about in the book. In getting back to the
perfect
storm, when you think about the financial crisis, here we have sudden new world. A completely new world. We were going along thinking that, you know, housing prices would always be high. We have jobs that are secure. And suddenly everything crashes. Everything is new. Everything is different. And it's uncontrollable. It's unpredictable and it's uncontrollable. And so there is a perfect storm of triggers to the stress response that are coming from this new world.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. We're going to take a call now from a listener in Aurora. Our guest is Esther Sternberg. She's a medical doctor, and she's the author most recently of Healing Spaces, The Science of Place and Well-Being. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. Join the discussion with your questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455. Let's take this call now from a listener in Aurora waiting for us on line four. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Well, you're talking about something that I hope I'm on the tail end of. Started about 3 weeks ago. My grandson could not find work, even though he was a college graduate, so he decided to join the Army. And, of course, with the country at war, that devastated me, just devastated me. And then I got a letter from the IRS that says I owe them $14,000 from 1980. That, I don't know, you know, it was just, I just went crazy. I hate letters from the IRS. I guess nobody does. So, and then there's another one that I don't want to talk about, but it's as stressful as any of the other two I mentioned.
Well, it sounds like you're experiencing your own personal perfect storm of stress, and my heart goes out to you. These kinds of things are would stress absolutely.
What do you
anybody.
Mean by that? What my own personal? Wouldn't they all be personal?
Well, they're. Before we were talking more in societal terms, and we're hearing about it in very, very personal terms, and it's a heart-wrenching story. But one thing that I didn't get to earlier, and maybe this is the time to talk about, is the kinds of things people who find themselves in such circumstances like you can do.
Mm-hmm.
You can't get rid of the outside events, you know, the difficulty finding jobs and the war going on and the economy, but you can seek support from those around you, support from experts.
I did go to a therapist. I did.
That's a very good thing. And not only therapists. The therapists are very important in this. Just like you know, if you want to build up your body, you go to a gym with a trainer. If you want to build up your coping skills, therapists are really trainers for stress coping. But the other kind of support is your own support network in your family, in your community, in your religious organization, in your church. One of the things that I talk about in the article that I'd written, and actually in several interviews that I've done, is I think one of the difficulties with this current economic crisis is that people are almost are embarrassed to go to their friends if they've lost a job. it's almost easier to seek support from friends when you're sick, when you have an appendicitis, for example, or you know, that it's you feel like it's not your fault. It isn't your fault. What's happened now is certainly not your fault, and not anybody's fault. And I think to seek support from those around you in whatever way that they can help is a good thing. If only to talk to them, or whatever ways that they can help, just to be with other people. It really has, there's a lot of rich literature, scientific literature, studies that have shown that social support and being with friends is very important in helping people to heal, in helping people to cope with difficult situations. And
well, I have a daughter that's a nurse.
Oh, that's
wonderful. And that helps.
That's wonderful.
And, yeah. And the other thing I just wanted to say, I just couldn't eat. My stomach hurt all the time. It just rumbled. It just hurt. I just couldn't eat. Now, about, 3 weeks later, I finally am beginning to eat. But I'm afraid to eat because it'll hurt again.
Well, I mean, that's the kind of thing that you should tell your doctor.
Yes, I'm going to the doctor tomorrow.
But definitely that is also part of the brain stress response. I don't want to, you know, sometimes when we use the word stress because of this long history of the word stress in the popular culture, doctors might say, oh, it's just stress. Don't worry about it. Well, it's not just stress. It is as I mentioned, a physiological effect of the stress response. So what happens when you're stressed is your brain starts pumping out nerve chemicals and stress hormones that actually go directly to your stomach and directly to your intestines and make those organs squeeze down tight, just like a fist. And that's what's making you feel you lose your appetite, you have difficulty digesting. It's because of those nerve chemicals and stress hormones that are released during the stress response that are making you feel that way. So what really you're doing the right things by going to a therapist, by going to your doctor, by talking to your daughter, to structure a whole package of ways to cope with this very stressful circumstances that you're going through.
The odd thing about it, as old as I am, I have never, ever been at a time in my life where I had to gain weight. I'd lost tremendous amounts of weight. It's just funny to me. I'm just laughing about it. I think it's so funny. So I guess sometime in your life, you experience something you've never experienced before. I have to try to gain weight. So thank you so much.
Well, I hope we could help.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Dr. Esther Sternberg, author most recently of Healing Spaces, The Science of Place and Well-Being. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions, comments. Maybe you've got a story to share with us this afternoon. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, and toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the things I think our caller said that I thought was interesting is she's feeling better.
Mm-hmm.
And we're pretty resilient.
Yes.
And I think that that's important to remind ourselves of as well. How resilient is the brain?
Oh, it's very resilient. Although there are things that one can do to help that resilience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, certainly the caller is doing a lot of things that are helping her resiliency simply by, as I said, seeking help from experts and from her family. And that will lower that stress response and help the brain sort of bounce back. Another thing that is typical of all stress systems, and again in all animals, is that the longer we're exposed to one of these novel situations, the less stressful it becomes. Simply repetition. It gets boring. It's called habituation in medical terms, but really it just means the more you're repeatedly exposed to whatever the stressful situation is, it's less able to trigger that stress response. So time heals all. Well, time heals in part because our brains get used to the situation. It's not so new anymore. But there are things that you can do actively to help. I mentioned to the caller about seeking social support. That's very important. But things like exercise. Exercise is a great stress coping mechanism. Meditation. Any of the kinds of things that we do to get ourselves in a state of belief, whatever it is that you believe in, it, whether it's a higher being or belief in country. You know, the caller mentioned that her son joined the army. Well, you know, there is tremendous camaraderie and belief in country in the army that helps people, the troops, sustain themselves through really stressful times. And there's, getting back to exercise, healthy lifestyle is very important. I mentioned that chronic stress speeds chromosomal aging and helps fray those ends of chromosomes so that you age more quickly. Well, it turns out, studies have been done by Dean Ornish recently showing that a healthy lifestyle change that includes half an hour of walking a day. So the exercise doesn't have to be, you know, running a marathon. Half an hour of walking, gentle exercise, some simple meditation, and a healthy Mediterranean diet. The combination can really stop those stressful effects in its tracks. In 3 months, of that healthy lifestyle change, those negative effects of stress can be reversed or at the very least stop worsening.
Mm-hmm. Maybe it would be a good now to talk about something that takes us back to the 1980s and the Windows study.
Yes.
And the impact our physical surroundings have on us and our ability to heal and deal with stress.
Well, that's as you mentioned, the topic of my book, Healing Spaces.
Mm-hmm.
And I start with this wonderful story of Roger Ulrich, who's a psychophysiologist, a psychologist who is particularly interested in the effects of the environment on health. And he showed in a landmark study in 1984 that was published in the journal Science, so it was in one of the most prestigious scientific journals, he showed that patients who were recovering from gallbladder surgery, whose beds were beside windows with views of nature, of a grove of trees, healed on the average a day sooner and needed less pain medication than patients whose windows had a view of a brick wall. And in the book, I asked the question, how could that be? What is it about a view of nature that can help one heal? And really, the whole book answers that question. But you can break it down into its simplest parts. Is it what you see out the window? Is it the light that streams in the window? Is
mm-hmm.
it the color? Is it the sounds? Is it the smells? Is it the ability to meditate when you're looking out the window? Is there something else about our environment that can help you heal? Is it what we touch? Is it whether we're able to move around, exercise in it? Is it simply removing negative factors that can be triggering stress? And, of course, the answer is all of the above. And to the extent that we can surround ourselves or place ourselves in an environment that can support all of those senses, vision, touch, smell, hearing, and remove stressful environmental factors, then we can support and help healing. And I talk about that in the chapter on hospitals and well-being, but it doesn't have to only be applied to hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
We can apply it to our own personal space.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, Dr. Esther Sternberg, author most recently of Healing Spaces, The Science of Place and Well-Being. Let's take another call, a listener in Urbana on a cell phone, line one. Hi. Line one? Hold on. Okay. Are we ready, Henry? Hi. Line one. Go ahead. We got you now.
Hi. Okay. Thank you. I hope this is not redundant, but I just tuned in, and I had a question on, like, maybe the physiological reasons why sometimes when I get stressed out, a good night of sleep, maybe even two good nights of sleep, doesn't work. The only thing that'll work is what I call working it out, running, you know, doing some serious physical exercise just sort of to get my body to the point where it's really, you know, kind of ready to collapse. And then that after that night of sleep, I'm all better. And the other thing, which is similar, is that I don't think Americans are aware of enough is the use of, like, sauna and sort of a heat treatment. I'll take my answer off the line.
Those are two great questions. Sleep is, of course, a very important way of coping with stress and also healing. Adequate sleep is very important in the healing process. But often when you're stressed, you don't sleep, you don't fall asleep, or you wake up in the middle of the night. Or if you are sleeping, you have a very fitful sleep. You may not be aware of it, but your sleep is broken up and you're waking up in micro awakenings, it's called. And in fact, the stress hormones, those same stress hormones that make you feel stressed out and anxious during the day, are doing their work at night. And that's how they're interrupting your sleep. So one of the reasons we wake up in the morning at the time that we do is there's a burst of these stress hormones that are released that wake you up. And that's a good thing. You, of course, want to wake up when it's time to wake up in the morning. The problem with being chronically stressed or even acutely stressed, just being stressed, is that those stress hormones and nerve chemicals get released much earlier in the middle of the night. So they can wake you up at 2 or 3 in the morning, and then you feel as if you're wide awake and ready to go for the day. But then, of course, when 8 o'clock rolls around, you're ready to go back to sleep. So it's very interesting, the two things that the caller mentioned of how he copes with this probably poor sleep quality when he's stressed. The exercise and the sauna are two ways to actually improve sleep and improve that sleep quality. There have been studies that show, if I go back to the sauna example, there are studies that show that a warm bath that increases core body temperature can be as effective as a sleeping pill in putting people to sleep. So that's a really great way to relax, to get yourself down from that high. You know, if you're all revved up and ready to go, it's very hard to get to the point of falling asleep. Watching TV, detective shows just before you go to sleep is not a good idea because that's going to keep you all revved up. But getting in a warm bath and calming down and raising your core body temperature can certainly help you fall asleep. And working out, exercising to the point of being really tired is a good way to not only help you fall asleep because you're tired, but exercising also takes you offline, in the figurative sense, not only literal. Not only does it take you away from your computer, but it helps you. It distracts you. It's almost like a meditation. I swim every day, and I always find that no matter what is stressing me out, after about 20 minutes of that swim, it may be 15 minutes, I get into a zone where it doesn't really matter to me what it was that was stressing me before I started. And that aura lasts hours after the exercise bout.
What can you tell us about meditation and how it could either rev us up or calm us down?
Well, there are wonderful studies on meditation now and what the brain does when one is meditating. Richie Davidson, quite close to where you are at University of Wisconsin in Madison, has done wonderful studies on brain imaging in meditating monks. He's done this in collaboration with the Dalai Lama. And he's found that there are certain brain regions that become active when you're meditating and other brain regions that become quiescent and are less active. And interestingly, the parts of the brain that are involved in resiliency, we were talking about resiliency before, become active in people who are meditating. Another thing that happens when you're meditating is there's a synchronization of electrical activity all over the brain. It's the kind of thing that happens when you've learned something, that aha moment. You know, you've been riding a bicycle, you've practiced and you've gotten on the bicycle 20, 30, 40, 50 times and fallen off, and then suddenly you learn. And that moment, that aha moment, something happens that connects many, many different parts of the brain. And that kind of thing happens in meditation. We don't know exactly what that does, but we do know that it seems to be associated with aspects of resiliency. There's another thing that happens at that moment when there's synchronization, and the monks that Richie Davidson has studied report feelings of extreme compassion at that moment, of deep love and compassion. So in the book, I describe my experience when I was moderating a panel with the Dalai Lama, with Richie Davidson, actually, and the Dalai Lama, when the Dalai Lama was here in Washington. And the panel was addressing the question of the use of meditation to help reduce stress and stress-related illnesses. And I was told that I couldn't use the word stress because it wasn't a word in the Buddhist tradition. Hmm. But that left me in a quandary and made me feel very stressed because how can you moderate a panel about stress and not use the word stress? So I started actually with that question. You know, we here in the West try to use meditation to reduce stress, but I understand that that's not a word in the Buddhist tradition, and I asked the Dalai Lama to explain what it is that he does, what he uses meditation for, what his followers use meditation for. And he said it's simple, compassion, to increase love. And that was such an insight for me in the difference of how we in the West use meditation to try to get rid of the negative. But really enhancing the positive is as effective, if not more effective, in reducing stress and getting rid of all these negative effects of stress than simply trying to get rid of the negative.
Mm-hmm. So in a sense, meditation, let me process this a little bit. It could help us stimulate good things while calming down the noise.
Exactly. And that's what I talk about in the book in several chapters, in Healing Thought and Healing Prayer and Hormones of Hope and Healing, to try to understand what it is about those positive factors that could be helping healing. And, in fact, there are many positive factors that get released in the brain when one is feeling love. And interestingly, for your audience in Champaign-Urbana, one of the researchers who made these discoveries actually made them first at the University of Champaign-Urbana, at the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana. And that's Sue Carter, who did the landmark studies looking at sex hormones in the brain that are involved, and other hormones in the brain that are involved in pair bonding and affiliative behavior, and really in various forms of love. And the reason that she originally did her work in your area, she was studying prairie voles, and the area around it was then called, I guess, Urbana-Champaign, was perfect for these little prairie voles. So she was able to study these animals that had differences in pair bonding, the prairie voles that were monogamous and the mountain voles that were not monogamous. And she was able to show differences in the brain in these brain hormones in these two different types of creatures, and went on to do studies when she was here in Maryland with Tom Insel on other kinds of hormones in the brain that are involved in this kind of pair bonding and affiliative behavior. But you know, when we think about what are the positive things that could be happening in the brain when one is feeling compassion and love, it can be these hormones that are released that, in fact, turn out to counter, to block that stress response, in addition to be positive and have effect on their own on healing.
What does this tell us, then, very practically, about the importance of touch?
Oh, there's. I also talk about touch in the book as well. Tiffany Field is a really did the landmark studies on touch in neonates, in preemie babies. She noticed when her own baby was born prematurely that massage, a simple form of massage and touch, actually seemed to calm the baby and allow the baby to eat more and to gain more weight. And since then, this was about 30 years ago, more and more studies have been done that show that, in fact, when these premature infants are being massaged gently, the relaxation response kicks in. So we've talked a lot about the stress response, but there are brain pathways, nerve chemicals, brain hormones that are released when you're in a state, one of these positive states of relaxation. And it turns out that massage can certainly trigger those. And the best studies that really prove that are in these premature infants, so that more and more preemie nurseries now are incorporating this gentle massage treatment on a daily basis so that the infants can thrive and grow. And actually, this speaks a little bit to what the first caller said, is that, you know, when she was stressed, her stomach was all tied up in knots.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when you are, when one massages an infant, those relaxation pathways kick in that untie those knots, that allow the digestive system to relax and to do its job, and the juices start flowing and the intestines start doing their job without being all tied up in knots.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Dr. Esther Sternberg, author most recently of Healing Spaces, The Science of Place and Well-Being. We have to wrap up pretty quickly now. I would like you to talk a little bit about, early in the book you talk about Sir Christopher Wren.
Oh, yeah.
And it made me think of places that one can go where one feels at ease, not asleep, but you know what I mean?
It's
comfortable, comforted and comfortable. What can you say about our immediate surroundings, our homes, the places that we visit, the places that we may go to worship, the places we go to camp, whatever? Those, it seems to me that's important to well-being.
Right, absolutely. And in the last chapter, I address that. Called Healing Gardens and My Place of Peace. And I describe how when my mother was dying of breast cancer and I was extremely stressed, I developed an inflammatory arthritis, which was a little bit ironic because here I am, I'm a rheumatologist and arthritis doc. My research is on the role of stress and arthritis, and I get stressed and I get arthritis. And I think until I had my own personal experience, I didn't fully grasp how important it is to actively try to create an environment that can help you heal, a place of comfort. And really, that's what this whole book is about. I inadvertently, after my mother died and I moved into a new house in Washington, I inadvertently recreated my mother's home. I didn't even realize it until I had finished redoing the deck and realized suddenly that it looked awfully like my mother's home. And I think we can reach back into our own personal lives and find things that make us, that remind us of better times, of happier times. In the book, I do talk a lot about memory. Because memory is very important, and it's different things for different people. But you know, you said in our place of worship, frankincense, the smell of frankincense at Christmas, the smell of a fireplace at Christmas can remind you of happy times in childhood, or the smell of jasmine on the night air. of, you know, having been at a wonderful seaside resort. Or so smells are very important. Views, I talk about views and how looking at a beautiful view can trigger those positive memories and positive parts of the brain that can help you heal. And you just go through each of your senses and try to find in your own life environments that can help you heal. If you can't create it in your own, if you live in an apartment and you don't have a garden, then there are lots of gardens and places to go to, in, you know, in your surroundings. I live very close to the National Cathedral, and there's a wonderful Bishop's Garden here at the National Cathedral. And I describe that in the book as well, of how I went there when I was really distraught when my father died. And that you can find places of peace, even in the smallest, tiniest little gardens, or going out into the country and the natural world. I describe in the book the healing cities, healing world, and how what's good for the environment, what's good for green, what's good for our planet, turns out to be good for ourselves. Take a walk in the woods.
There we've got to wrap it up, I'm sorry to say. Mm. It's been such a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you, and I hope that your listeners, especially the ones who called, were helped by this.
Yeah. Dr. Esther Sternberg has been our guest in this portion of the program. She's the author of Healing Spaces, The Science of Place and Well-Being. The book is published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. Our guest, Dr. Sternberg, is a medical doctor who's done a lot of research on brain-immune interactions and the effects of the brain's stress response on health.